Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, will concerns about election security be quelled after a relatively smooth day at the polls? And Mesa is facing a lawsuit over allegations of censorship at its art museum. But first this morning, Donald Trump has been elected president once again. And though the race has yet to be called here in Arizona, he holds about a 100,000 vote lead over Vice President Kamala Harris in our state this morning. But though the race at the top of the ticket may be over, from the Senate to the House to the state legislature, winners have yet to be called in many races across the state, and the margins are often razor thin. Here to give us the latest is Wayne Shetsky with KJZZ's Politics Desk. Good morning there, Wayne. Got enough coffee?
Yeah, I got enough. Good morning.
You're awake. Okay. So let's start at the biggest race that has yet to be called here in Arizona, the race between Democratic Congressman Ruben Gallego and Republican Carrie Lake. Gallego was holding a strong lead for much of the night last night, but it has narrowed, it seems.
Yeah, that trends with a lot of the other races we've seen where Republicans were trailing and either flipped to the lead or closed those gaps. But Gallego has maintained a decently sizable lead while some other races have actually flipped.
Lake has been underperforming Trump in Arizona, and it seems she's sort of a representative of this truism in the Trump era that some of his acolytes just don't play as well as he tends to.
Yeah, and so she's basically running on the Trump playbook, and as you said, other candidates who have tried to do the same thing don't always fare as well. I mean, he had a lot of other things to run on that she didn't. You know, they're running on the current administration and as a referendum on inflation and that kind of thing, and it's just kind of harder to do that when you're one of 100 instead of kind of running a one-on-one type of campaign.
Okay. So that's a Senate seat, and it's clear now that Republicans will take control of the Senate in Washington next year. But let's turn now to the House, where Democrats are trying to flip seats to gain control there. We have two incredibly tight races for congressional seats playing out here in Arizona. Let's start, Wayne, with CD1, where Democrat Amish Shaw is trying to unseat David Schweikert. Schweikert is up nearly 5,000 votes right now, but tell us what's left to be counted. How could that shift the race?
Yeah, so basically what's left to be counted, is, at least in Maricopa County, is what we call late earlies. Those are the folks that voted using an early mail-in ballot but decided to drop it off on election day. So those are the last votes that are counted. I think Democrats are banking on some historic norms that would go their way, and that could help Shaw, who was leading for most of the night until they started counting all the election day votes. They're hoping that would flip that back in his direction. Shaw's a former state legislator. He's really good at knocking on doors, so he was able to get a lot of face time in that district. But yeah, Schweikert has survived many close challenges from Democrats in recent years.
Yeah, okay. See what happens there. Let's talk about Southern Arizona 6th District down there. We've got a rematch, essentially, there, but it seems to have flipped from last time around.
Yeah, we've got Juan Ciscomani, who's a first-term Republican congressman, former staffer for former Governor Doug Ducey, kind of seen as a rising star among that more moderate, Ducey type of Republican in the party, facing Kirsten Engel, a former Democratic state lawmaker. But she actually came out with a sizable lead with early results, just like the other race that narrowed, but she actually held on to that lead. And, you know, so if those late earlies end up going Democrats' way, as they hope, you could see her unseating him and Democrats flipping that seat.
Very interesting. Okay, so let's head down ballot to your bread and butter, Wayne, the state legislative races, where there are also some incredibly tight margins, some big stakes here. Democrats have talked about taking control of one or both chambers of the state legislature for a very long time, and it doesn't look like that will happen in the House at this point.
Yeah, but I'm going to caveat all of this with this is really early, and there are so many races in really close districts that it's just too soon to tell. But as the numbers stand right now, we would have a split Senate, so 15-15, and then Republicans actually gaining one seat in the House. But again, for instance, in the Senate, we have Democratic Senator Christine Marsh in a Phoenix area competitive district who's up by just 38 votes now. So again, it's all going to come down to the way that those remaining votes, which direction they slide. So you could easily see that flipping. We've got several other seats, both in Republican and Democratic hands, in both chambers that are divided by 2,000 votes or less. And that's really is is going to be what's going to determine in the next few days which parties control both of those chambers or whether we have ties.
Okay, so a lot still could change at those local levels. And if the Democrats are able to tie the Senate, what does that do? How does that shift the balance of power?
Well, that creates kind of a power-sharing situation where basically both sides have to figure out who's going to be the leader. You know, from either party could be. It just depends on who can kind of swing the most votes in their direction, so which lawmaker. And that means there's going to be a lot of horse trading, control of committees, that kind of thing. And that basically determines whose bills get heard. So even if Democrats get a tie, it is going to give them a lot more power than they've had it in recent memory down at the legislature to just kind of move their agenda.
Okay. I want to talk quickly about the Maricopa County Recorder's race. You've got an kind of unknown Democrat running against Republican Justin Heap. Tim Stringham is that Democrat. This is an important office. It's the person who helps run elections in one of the country's largest counties. This is a tight one.
Yeah. This I'm going to sound like a broken record, but again, Stringham was up early. And then as those election day votes were counted, Heap took a few percentage point lead. But again, there's still enough votes left to swing this either way. I'd say they're both mostly unknown countywide. Mm-hmm. Heap is a state lawmaker. State lawmakers don't have the best name recognition, but he did get an endorsement from Donald Trump, so that really helped boost him. And then Stringham is a Democrat, a Navy and an Army veteran running to try and keep an election denier out of office. Heap, on the other side, won't come out and say past elections were stolen, but he's definitely, like I said, endorsed by Carrie Lake, Donald Trump, and in that vein of the party. Mm-hmm. But again, when the name recognition is so low, it's unclear how many voters actually knew about that dichotomy between the two and how many were just voting along party lines.
Yeah. Okay. I want to hit quickly in the last minute or so here, Wayne, on some of the ballot measures that have been called at this point. No surprises that the abortion rights measure passed, as well as the legislature's immigration measure. We've talked about that on the show. Voters, though, rejected a measure pushed by the Arizona Restaurant Association to change the way tipped workers are paid. Was that a surprise?
I don't necessarily think it was a surprise. I mean, if you remember, voters actually voted to increase the minimum wage in the state several years ago. So I think they, when you hear the concept of trying to allow folks to pay people less than the minimum wage, and then you get into the formula by which that would be decided, it's kind of confusing. And I think the through line we saw here is the stuff that's easy to explain by and large passed. And the stuff that was either esoteric or difficult to explain, we had something on, you know, state rulemaking and how that gets done that didn't pass either. Uh-huh. Those ones had less of a chance of getting across. When people don't understand something, or when voters perceive that you're trying to take away one of their powers as voters, they usually vote against stuff.
All right. And that's what we saw kind of across the board there. Okay. A very quick rundown of a lot of tight races, lots yet to be called. KJZZ's Wayne Shutsky joining us. Wayne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so that is where many of these uncalled races stand this morning after Election Day. Let's turn now to talk about how the elections were actually run. There were mounting concerns leading up to Election Day that voters and poll workers would face safety threats, that votes might be unfairly counted, that misinformation would rule the day at the polls. But things went fairly smoothly, and Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes joins us now in studio to tell us why. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Great. Thank you for coming in. So after so much prepping, right, so much talk about security, so much talk about safety concerns, so much talk about election denialism leading up to this election, were you surprised at how things went yesterday?
No, I wasn't surprised because we were prepared. We started work on this back in January of 2023 when I took office. And let's not forget, I'm the first Secretary of State in about 40 years who was actually a local election official first. And so I knew what kind of team to build. I knew what questions to ask coming right out of the gate. And we did a great job getting the counties who actually run our elections,
right,
the resources they need, the training they needed. And we really put the focus in the right places. And I think, but for some of the things that happened in Apache County, it was pretty much a flawless election. There were, you know, little bumps and bruises here. We had one polling place where someone didn't show up with a key to the supply closet, so they had to wait 20 minutes to get ballots out. And another one in another part of the state where there was a short power outage right at the beginning, but right, they were open by 6:20 in the morning anyway. So all in all, very safe, very secure. I think even though there were long lines because of the length of the ballot, mm-hmm, there were no technical problems and there were no safety problems to speak of. Again, outside of Apache County, So, yeah, I feel really good, and the team across the entire state did a fantastic job.
Let me ask you quickly about Apache County. This is in far northern Arizona, largely Indian country, Navajo Nation up there. The Navajo Nation filed a lawsuit kind of at some point yesterday saying we need to keep the polls open longer because of these problems. It was problems with printers, with electronic poll books. Tell us a little bit about what happened here and how things work slightly differently there.
Well, yeah, it was a confluence of a couple of different issues at the same time, and it was unfortunate. What ended up happening was many of their polling places did not open for some time, but we had some of those backups that are naturally in place. A lot of folks were using the assisted ballot marking devices to get their ballots taken care of. Lots of provisional ballots were issued, the vast majority of which, of course, are going to count. It's just a different way of voting. And so we're going to look a little bit more closely to get all of the details about what happened up there. The Navajo Nation did petition the court to hold open those polling places for 2 extra hours. And look, some folks that didn't get a chance to vote earlier because the lines were too long came back. There were folks who were coming to stand in line in 40-degree weather late in the evening. And it's a lot colder up there than it is down here in the valley. But those voters gave us hope, right? Because they came out, they wanted to stand in line, they wanted to vote, and I believe we managed not as well as we could have up there, but I think we did an okay job.
So you're confident that everyone who wanted to vote up there was able to vote?
I'd like to say that I'm 100% confident in that, but you know, in this business, there are too many anecdotal stories that we hear about folks who just gave up to be 100% sure, but we did everything we needed to do across the state to try to prepare each of the counties to be able to do this, because these are local elections run at the county level. And so getting that training together, getting those resources together, we were hoping for better performance. But, you know, we'll see what happened and do better next time.
I want to ask about security concerns as well here and in other places around the country. There were a lot of stories, and the police were down there at some point last night looking at bomb threats reportedly of Russian origin. That happened here as well. What happened and how was it handled?
So really what started was a series of emails that were sent out first for threats in Navajo County. Those were without foundation, and they came from a .ru email site, which is usually a Russian email site. So without confirming the attribution there, we did what we needed to do according to the playbook. We responded appropriately with our partners in federal, state, and local law enforcement. The investigation moved forward, and then another threat popped up, and then another. We had several of them around the state. In fact, I don't have the running total in front of me, but it was all the way from southern Arizona to along the Colorado River and up in northern Arizona as well. So it was a pattern. It was the same sort of thing. Nobody was ever unsafe, but we treated every single one of them with the urgency they required. And again, we responded well because we trained well, we prepared well, and I'm very proud of that.
Okay. So there was a lot of talk, as I said, about election integrity, trust in the election system, election safety heading into this. You've talked about your own safety, about wearing a bulletproof vest leading up to this election because of concerns about that. Do you think the way things went yesterday will quell some of those concerns?
Nope. I don't. You know, we've already received messages this morning about, well, you know, we know you're going to delay the results because you want to inject ballots, but Arizona doesn't matter, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, these sorts of things, they happen. And there's folks out there who think it's a good idea to, you know, threaten, harass and intimidate elections officials. And, you know, that's it's against the law, number one. And number two, it's you know, it's just a thing that we have to deal with now, unfortunately. And so we've prepared for that just like we prepared for everything else. And I think we dealt with all of that stuff the way it needed to be dealt with. And all in all, I think this is a very good election in Arizona.
Have you been concerned about your own safety leading up to this?
Well, we've been taking whatever precautions are necessary and advised by our law enforcement folks, right? I'm not a safety expert almost sometimes now. I kind of feel like one a little bit, but you know, I get advice from some of the best folks in the field, and we do what is necessary based on the circumstances that we're presented with.
Okay, last question for you, and I want to ask you about this as a candidate on the Democratic side leading up to the next election. Democrats,
you're running me already?
Democrats are likely to lose Arizona at the top of the ticket. At least it looks like that at this point, although things are still up in the air, as we know. What's your reaction to what's happened around the country today?
Well, I think, look, Democrats need to pay attention. we need to listen more, and I think we need to be a lot more humble. You know, we've also got to pay close attention to the notion that I've been talking about for a long time. I used the same philosophy in my own campaign in 2022. You run to win. You can govern later, but you've got to be competitive. You've got to attack the problems that people are facing and not attack the problems that you think are problems, right? We've got to be humble in our servant leadership, and that is let the people out there show us what their problems are and then attack those problems. And then if you've got some agenda down the road, if you want to make some adjustments in the way things work, do it slowly, do it steadily, lead people through it. That's the time to educate. That's the time to really take coalition building for reals. But if you want to win, you've got to win where the people want you to win. Mm. You've got to fight the monsters that they're facing. And this election tells me, if I'm playing political analyst and not Secretary of State, this election tells me the same thing that Bill Clinton told us all. It's the economy, stupid. It's not the greater economy. It's the kitchen table economy.
Okay.
And that's where I think the voters were across the country last night.
We'll leave it there for now. Arizona of State Secretary of State Adrian Fontes joining us. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, even in our modern times, it's not about the survival of the fittest. We'll hear from a co-author who applied Darwin's theories to humanity's future on Earth. The city of Mesa is facing a lawsuit from the former chief curator of its contemporary arts museum over a controversy that started more than a year ago when the city was accused of censorship for postponing an exhibition featuring famed artist Shepard Fairey. Tiffany Farrell is accusing the city of violating her First Amendment rights for trying to get her to remove a controversial print from a 2023 exhibition featuring Fairey's work that city officials allegedly thought might offend police. Farrell refused, but the city terminated her employment the next year, she says, in retaliation. But according to our next guest, that was just one example of censorship by the city outlined in this lawsuit. Lynn Trimble has been covering the story for Southwest Contemporary. She's on the line now to tell us more. Hi there, Lynn.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So let's start with what's in this lawsuit. Tiffany Farrell is accusing the city of Mesa of First Amendment violations, essentially. What's her argument?
It's a very, it's a 25-page document, and it's very complex. It's got quite a few layers. Essentially, there are six different counts. They have different defendants, different former and current employees of the city of Mesa, as well as the city of Mesa, which is the main defendant. And she's actually looking at four different violations of law or statute. You mentioned the one, First Amendment rights, mm-hmm. Also the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the reason you see such sort of a broad swath of legal reasoning there is that she's talking not only about the censorship of, with Shepard Fairey's show and other shows, but she's also talking about via the lawsuit, of course, she hasn't publicly commented, but via the lawsuit, she's expressing sort of what happened in the aftermath, right? Because it's been more than a year, mm-hmm. and she's talking about things that have happened since, and it gets into a lot of complex issues around how people may be treated differently based on gender or racism allegations. It's quite a hefty brew of of concerns that she's got.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of that in a moment. Remind us, Lynn, what happened here with this Shepard Fairey show?
Yes.
This ultimately happened, but there were some changes to the show. It was postponed last year when this all went down. What was the controversy?
The initial controversy surrounded the city manager asking Farrell, as chief curator, to remove a work of art from the show. He asked them to remove a work called My Florist is a Dick. He objected to it based on the language, as well as the fact that the graphic for this artwork involves a police officer in riot gear with a skeletal face, and he felt it was an unflattering depiction of law enforcement, and mm-hmm. expressed concern that city employees, that Mesa police officers, might take offense, and has expressed in other meetings we've attended and so forth that didn't align with city values, of respect for employees and so forth. So it started with that, and Tiffany declined to remove the work.
Right.
Of course, then there was a domino effect.
Right. So talk a little bit about that. There were two artists who were not in the show when it finally did appear at the Mesa Arts Center there. And it was postponed.
Correct. The city's approach, as alleged in, you know, documents, and also as I reported from attending meetings mm-hmm. where defendants have spoken, the city decided to put a pause on the exhibition mm-hmm. so that they could ascertain what should we do? They thought about putting an alternative exhibition in the space. Actually, it would have been a showcase of Mesa's recent receipt of an All-American City Award.
Right.
They had planned an opening, I believe it was in September. And, you know, when the controversy ensued, the city basically decided we want more time to work this out. And over the course of that month, during conversations, the result was that the Shepherd Fairey show moved forward. It included the work that had been in dispute with signage helping to set context that the city felt was important for context for that piece of art. And then there were two exhibitions that happened as well. And there were two artists locally based, Arizona based, Thomas Breeze Marcus and Douglas Miles, who had been planning, were slotted to have solo exhibitions. And in conversations with the city, which they have discussed publicly, had basically decided that they, you know, between the city and the artist, there were not agreements about what would be shown.
Right.
And so the exhibitions were not shown. And I have to tell you, it's one of the really most jarring things I've seen in an art exhibit here or anywhere is to walk into gallery spaces where you're used to seeing, particularly local artists, mm-hmm. their work shown, and those spaces were left empty.
Wow. So you mentioned the signage the city put in. They put up signs sort of saying, mm-hmm. you know, this does not represent necessarily the views of the city, right? Mm-hmm. You also reported that the city, in the lawsuit at least, it said that the city changed its artist contracts and curation procedures following this, and Farrell took issue with that, it sounds like.
Yes, the city has talked about, you know, again, in public meetings and so forth, has talked about changing the controls on what gets shown so that the city will have more city officials, specifically the city manager's office, would have more notice of what artwork was being shown, that they would be told sooner about artwork so that if there was something objectionable or they wanted to get community feedback, they would have time to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And they have not, since the original controversy, they have not released, you know, publicly released a new set of guidelines. So we don't know the extent to which they have formalized new practices and policies, but we know they've been under discussion. But what we do know is that their intention is to have greater control. And of course, that's one of the big controversies here, as stated in the lawsuit, is mm-hmm. how much control can a city or a government have over what's shown in an art space? Here, the city runs the art space.
Right.
So, you know, it's different than a public gallery.
Yeah, that's very interesting. What has the city of Mesa said about this lawsuit so far, Lynn?
The city of Mesa has told Southwest Contemporary that they're not commenting because it's pending litigation. So okay. That's the only comment that we've been able to receive so far.
All right, we'll leave it there. Lynn Trimble, Arizona-based arts writer, her piece on this lawsuit, as well as the controversy that preceded it, appears in Southwest Contemporary. Lynn, thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Grace Pinson is a bit of an anomaly. As a trans woman serving time in federal prison, she's part of a very small and uniquely vulnerable community. There are about 1,000 trans women serving time in federal penitentiaries, and according to one study, they're about 10 times as likely as other prisoners to be sexually assaulted. But Pinson stands out for another reason. More than once, she's sued the Bureau of Prisons and won. Beth Schwartzepfel is a journalist with the Marshall Project who's been reporting on Grace Pinson. She says Pinson's ability to secure judgments against the POB is remarkable, a testament to Pinson's intelligence and tenacity. But in a recent piece, Schwartzepfel tells the full story of one of Pinson's successful prosecutions, which is much more complicated. While Pinson technically won the case, it wasn't the kind of victory she was hoping for. Schwartzepfel spoke with the show's Sam Dingman. And a warning, the beginning of this story contains a description of assault.
If you can imagine being in essentially a 6x9 cell with another human being. And in Tucson, the cell doors, they're not like you see in the movies. They're not like bars. They're actually solid steel with a very small window. And imagine if something bad happens to you in that concrete box. How do you tell somebody? The cells are supposed to be equipped with a button where you can let the CO know that there's an emergency and you need help. In Grace's cell, there was no button. And Grace was housed with a man who was serving 16 years for sexual assault. And on this particular day, Grace says that he was threatening to rape her. She says that she warned the guards when they were making their rounds earlier in the day, he's threatening me, I need to be moved. And she says they ignored her. In any case, that night he attacked her. He punched her in the head over and over again. She curled up in the fetal position. And Grace says that every time she lifted up her hands to shield her face, he would reach down and try to yank off her pants. And every time she reached down to pull up her pants, he would punch her in the face again. And this went on for about 5 minutes. So people around her started kicking their doors. And it was started sort of echoing up and down the hallway, people's boots kicking doors. And eventually the guards did hear the kicking, made their way towards her cell and opened the door. And they found her basically beaten to a pulp. She was traumatized, but okay. And the prison determined that they could not substantiate that he had tried to sexually assault her.
Right, because the cellmate did not dispute the attack, correct?
At first he did, actually. At first he told investigators that she punched herself.
Right.
But I think it quickly became clear that that was kind of ridiculous, and he admitted that he did beat her.
Right. So then Grace ends up taking the prison to court, trying this case herself. Was she representing herself because she wanted to, or did she consider other options?
No, she definitely did not want to. She had actually asked the judge to appoint an attorney to represent her. And in one irony of her story, for all the years she was housed in Tucson, you know, she probably brought half a dozen lawsuits. And because of the way the judge distribution system happens, she had the same judge every time. And this judge would say, whenever she would ask for a lawyer, you know, plaintiff is an able litigator. She's good at this. And so I don't see why she needs a lawyer, essentially. But yes, she does usually, in a complex case like this, ask for an attorney, and she is almost always turned down.
I see. So what was her argument?
Initially, she tried to argue that the Bureau failed to keep her safe because she didn't have a functioning alarm in her cell. The Bureau, interestingly, said, there's no rule that we have to have an alarm. You know, it's nice that we provide one, and you're right that we often do, but, you know, you can't sue us for not providing it because we're not required to. And so Grace sort of pivoted and thought, well, this is my chance to prove that the Bureau has a problem with sexual assault, and that's because of the way the prison is run. But the judge shot that down. The law, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, that supposedly keeps people safe from sexual assault, you can't sue the prison if they don't follow it.
And that's even though, as you point out in the piece, the penitentiary in Tucson has been among the top 5% of federal facilities with the most allegations of sexual abuse or harassment since 2016.
Yes, and the Bureau, I mean, those numbers come from the Bureau itself. They're well aware of that. Their argument is essentially, you can't sue us for that. And you can't. They're not wrong. And so what they ended up arguing about was this very narrow question. Did Grace warn the officer? And if she warned him, did he fail to move her? And if he did fail to move her, was she injured by his failure? So it becomes a credibility contest. And in the end, the judge believed the officer. And so she would have lost, except for one thing. Some documents turned up right at the end of trial. The government said, oh, look, we found these documents. We re-reviewed our documents, and we did discover this one piece of paper that said that in the event that an incarcerated person presses an alarm, staff must respond immediately. And Grace said, I thought you said there were no rules about emergencies, responding in emergencies. And so she asked the judge for a mistrial because she said, how can you say that there are no rules about alarms, and then here's a rule about an alarm. And in the end, the judge agreed with Grace on that point and said they did have an obligation to provide an alarm, and because they didn't, she was injured more seriously than she would have been. And so the judge ordered the Bureau to pay her $10,000 in damages.
She was then subsequently transferred, right, to a different penitentiary.
She was. She was moved from Tucson to this unit in Pennsylvania that was still under construction. They only had 5 people in it. She said it was like a ghost town, essentially. She was basically housed not just by herself in a cell, but by herself in a whole unit. Mm-hmm. And she had no access to, you know, any activities, to work, to recreation. She had a psychology appointment 1 hour once a week, and that was pretty much it. As a friend of hers said, she's just served some really hard time.
This $10,000 judgment that she got, I imagine she was not upset to receive that money, but it also seems like that wasn't really the point for her.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. You know, she really wanted this trial to be, she thought of it as a sort of Me Too moment for the federal system. She wanted to make a larger point that she was prevented from making in the courtroom.
And so the Prison Rape Elimination Act, that statute that she was using as the basis for her suit, if the law says that the Bureau of Prisons can't be sued for failing to protect prisoners, does that law have any teeth? I mean, is there any accountability for the Bureau of Prisons based on that statute?
The short answer is no. Prisons are supposed to be audited every few years. And if the auditor finds ways in which they could be doing better, the auditor can require the prison to make changes. But more importantly, the auditors rarely do require much of the prison. So for instance, in Tucson, in the most recent audit, and I'm going to quote here from her report, she said, all transgender inmates interviewed reported that they were asked about their safety, but felt staff did not take their concerns seriously. So that doesn't sound good, right? But the auditor did not require any corrective action. And in fact, in that area said that the prison exceeded the standard. You know, what a lot of experts said to me is that the audits are essentially useless.
Well, Beth Schwartz-Apfel is a staff writer with the Marshall Project. Her piece for the Marshall Project about Grace was called Assaulted by Her Cellmate, A Trans Woman Took the Federal Prisons to Court. Beth, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. I really appreciate your interest in the story and in the subject.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Let's turn now to another check-in on election results on this post-election day morning. Donald Trump has won the White House again and is likely to win Arizona, as well as votes continue to be counted. So let's take a moment to look at who turned out in Arizona yesterday. And as many local races remain too close to be called, what's left to be counted? For more on that, I'm joined by ABC 15's data guru, Garrett Archer, who has been tirelessly following the numbers through all of this. Good morning to you, Garrett.
Good morning.
I hope you got some sleep. Okay, so let's start with what's left to be counted here. We had Wayne Shutsky from KJZZ on our show earlier this morning talking about Democrats kind of banking on those early ballots that were dropped off on Election Day. How many are left?
It looks like we have probably around 1 million ballots left to be counted here that are the sum total of all late early is what we call it we call them late early ballots, which are the ballots that are dropped off on Election Day.
Right. Okay. So 1 million sounds like a whole lot. How much could that impact some of these tight races? What are you watching for as these votes continue to be counted in the next several days?
Well, what I find in my experience is that the late early drop offs tend to be it's a mix of both the early votes and the Election Day votes. So, but it's a muted version of each. So, for example, last night, on Election Day, mm-hmm. Donald Trump did tend to win election day votes by a pretty considerable amount, 20, 30 points in some places, including Maricopa County, where the early vote was the opposite. Harris tended to win early vote drops. And so the election day ballots, the drop-off tend to be sort of a mix of both. So it and it really depends on what that mix is. So we will start seeing them come in today, and we will be able to see what those trends are and mm-hmm. see if they are friendly or friendly to Democrats, or if they're basically just, a wash, if you will.
Yeah, a wash. So do those trends, when you start to see those numbers come in today, do those trends tend to hold?
Yeah, the early ballot trends do. The late early trends do tend to hold. It's just the way that sort of statistics works. It's a large population of people, and it will tend to be, in certain counties, they tend to vote the same. So, the late early drop-offs in Pinal County are going to behave, a certain way, even no matter what the batches are. Maricopa might be different here and there, only because it just depends on where the batches come from. Maricopa is just so large. Mm-hmm. We'll find that sometimes, just by happenstance, late early ballots favor one area of a county over another, and that might change it ever so slightly.
Interesting. It's so granular. I want to talk about overall turnout that we know so far, at least in Arizona, and how that broke down along party lines. You mentioned that what happened on, who showed up to vote at the polls on election day. How did that favor Republicans versus Democrats?
We will have a better idea of what the actual numbers are a little later once voter histories are loaded into the county recorder systems. But what I can say is that just based on the results, this looks like probably the presidential election with the widest partisan split in Arizona between Republicans and Democrats for some time. And going in, just the registration split was the largest in history for Republicans. In Arizona, and it looks like the electorate, the people who actually turned out to vote, is going to be that way too. We may not even have records going back far enough to of vote histories to see another partisan split bigger than what we're going to see once the histories are loaded. I'm thinking it's probably going to be plus 8 Republican.
Very interesting. And yes, that voter registration advantage for Republicans is so big now. How did an independent stack up with what we've seen so far, Garrett?
It really depended on when they voted. So the independents that voted early did tend to support the Democratic candidate. And then the independents that voted on Election Day tend to support the Republican candidate. And that's yet another reason why the late earlies would be so interesting, is which independents actually dropped off their ballot. Were the ones that tend to support have a behavior of voting early and thus, tend to support the Democrat, or the opposite?
Very interesting. What do we know so far about demographic breakdowns here? Some of the demographic breakdowns of the counties in which these votes are being counted from, right? We've heard so much about how the Latino vote seemed to sway to Trump yesterday, especially among men. Are we able to extrapolate any of that right now in Arizona?
Yes. So we can extrapolate a little bit of that right now, just based on two of our counties that have the highest Hispanic population in the state, and that's Santa Cruz County and Yuma County. So Santa Cruz is about 85% Hispanic. In 2020, Joe Biden won that I'll just go with Donald Trump. Trump, he didn't win Santa Cruz, but in 2020 he got 31.7%. Right now he's holding at 40.4. So that is an 8-point advantage, 8-point overperformance of where he was in 2020 with Santa Cruz. And then in Yuma County, which is about 60% Hispanic, mm-hmm. Donald Trump does have Republicans can win that that county and have in the past. He won it in 2020, 52% of the vote. But this time he's winning 65%. So that's a 12-point change in his favor this year. So it does look like Hispanics really did shift really did shift in favor of Donald Trump this time.
Wow. Okay. Last question for you in the last 30 seconds or so here. What do we know about the gender breakdown here? A lot of talk about how this election had a lot to do with gender.
Yes, and what I can tell you about that is that the early ballots did tend to favor women voters, and women, eventually the electorate will be majority women, but the early ballots were favoring women voters. But in Maricopa County, at least, where we had live check-ins yesterday as those people were checking in to vote and voting, I did do a gender breakdown of them and found that they were actually mostly men. Mm. So mostly men came out yesterday to vote. And that's and since men, as we've seen in the polling, do tend to favor Donald Trump, that's one of the reasons why we saw such large vote shares for him coming in last night.
Fascinating stuff. Digging into the numbers, that is Garrett Archer, ABC15's data guru, joining us. Garrett, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Of course.
There's a lot of debate about what the Earth's future might look like, and along with that, what humanity's future might look like. Issues like climate change have some people concerned about our ability to continue to live on this planet, at least the way we currently do. Our next guest argues a Darwinian approach could be helpful, but only if we are willing to change the way we behave. Sal Agusta is an associate assistant professor in life sciences at Virginia Commonwealth University and co-author of the book, A Darwinian Survival Guide, Hope for the 21st Century. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, and they started with an interesting twist the book takes on what people know about Darwin and how they apply it to modern times.
Well, what got us thinking about it is we wrote a first book that was published in 2020 called The Major Metaphors of Evolution. And that book was, you know, about evolutionary theory. But in writing that, we got towards the end and started to delve into these more kind of applied issues and, you know, what it would look like to take an evolutionary perspective on the issue of climate change and basically how humans can survive the Anthropocene. And one of the things that we stumbled upon in that book was the common misconception that evolution is about survival of the fittest, which implies that only the absolute fittest survive. And when you start thinking about that, that justifies things like, you know, bigger is better, growth is good. But actually, evolution is about survival of the fit. And whoever reproduces is actually fit enough. So it's really about survival of the adequate. And So in applying that to what's the best way to be prepared to survive for the future, well, it's not being the absolute best at any given time. It's not having the most. It's not about making the most profit or cutting down the most trees to build the biggest forest. It's actually about living within your means and having potential for the future to deal with potential future change. And that's what evolution does.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is those who will be able to survive into the future are those who are sort of doing their thing. And as you say, living within their means and, you know, not yep. maybe not doing too much, but not doing too little.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the recognition that, you know, we can grow now, we can make profits, we can take ecosystem services from nature and so on and so forth. But we need to be doing that with a mind towards saving potential for the future.
Yeah. One of the things that you write about that I think is so interesting is how, in your opinion, at least, technology will not be able to save us, right, from some of the pending problems. It's got to be a behavioral change. And I'm wondering, like, what do we have to do? Like, what kind of behavioral changes are you advocating for?
Well, and this goes back to at least the 1960s. With a guy named Garrett Hardin, who wrote some famous essays about the tragedy of the commons. And he basically made the point that, you know, ultimately the answer to sustainability is what he called a no technical solution problem. In other words, technology can't save us. Technology can push things off to the future, but ultimately the problem actually persists. And he talked about something called the ratchet effect, where actually, every time we save ourselves with technology, we might make the problem worse because we're increasing human carrying capacity, increasing pressure on resources, and, you know, ultimately not solving the problem. And so basically what he said is that what's required is a change in behavior. Now, his feeling was that the fundamental behavior within the human population was selfishness. So he was very pessimistic about the ability to change behavior. But other people have come along to point out that even though humans are selfish, they also cooperate a lot. And in order to actually, you know, change our behavior in a way that's sustainable, we basically need to cooperate more
Well, so I guess what is the intersection between technology and behavior changes? Like, would you consider, for example, somebody getting rid of an SUV and buying an electric car? That is obviously using technology, but it's also a behavior change. Is that something that could be helpful here?
Well, and this is where we come in and say that, you know, switching from gas cars to electric cars is not ultimately what's going to, quote unquote, save us or make human existence sustainable. So the behavioral change, you know, and I'll go back to what we were just talking about. The behavioral change is a kind of change in the way we think about the world from a materialistic commons to what we call an evolutionary commons. And so basically that change in behavior is, instead of growth is good, bigger is better, make as much profit as fast as possible. Now, the change in behavior would be this kind of global redirection of living within our means and understanding that actually the way to be best prepared for the future is, again, to build potential, to be able to actually cope with change when it comes instead of trying to engineer everything so it doesn't change.
Well, it almost sounds like you're talking more about behavioral change sort of on the macro level as opposed to changes we might make on a day-to-day level, like, for example, drive an electric vehicle or putting solar panels on our roof or things like that, that, you know, a lot of people think if I do these things, that is helping us. That will help make the future more sustainable.
And I think our main point is that that only helps if, along with those changes, we're changing our fundamental behavior, getting away from what drives the global economics, which is this, you know, model of linear growth, you know, grow as much as fast as possible, as much as possible. And that is somehow a measure of, you know, a country's or a nation's success versus grow enough for, you know, for people to live, you know, what is considered to be a high quality of life, but also have, you know, potential built in to deal with the future. The other major behavioral change that we talk about ultimately is reducing population densities in climate insecure places. Ultimately, you know, there will be a rural revitalization, and that is going to constitute a change in behavior in the way people think about, you know, urban versus rural environments.
So you're saying that in the future, the trend of more and more urbanization, people coming from smaller communities into the cities, is going to reverse, and some number of people will be going back to those smaller communities?
Well, I don't know if it's going to reverse, but, you know, if we want to make the kind of changes that we need to make to be better able to cope with climate change and all the change that's coming, then one of the major behavioral changes that we need to make is to essentially decentralize and not cram ourselves into climate insecure urban centers, but actually start to spread out.
How likely do you think it is that enough people will be willing to make these behavioral changes to make a difference?
I mean, you know, I think when we're talking about the economics of well-being, that's a difficult one to see happening on a global scale, just because the economics of growth are so powerful. So that one's difficult to see. But in terms of, you know, reducing population densities in climate insecure places and in urban centers, it becomes more likely from the perspective of, you know, essentially people being forced to do these things, you know, as cities heat up and as sea levels rise, then I think, you know, moving inland and moving into more climate secure places will become natural and more likely, although one could imagine lots of conflict, you know, resulting from that also. So,
sure, that is interesting. All right, Sal, thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
All right, I appreciate it.
Sal Augusta is an assistant professor in life sciences at Virginia Commonwealth University and co-author of the book A Darwinian Survival Guide: Hope for the 21st Century.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.